from the Hill Country in Texas, broadcasting worldwide, this is OneRadioNetwork.com.
Good morning. This is OneRadioNetwork.com. The telephone number is 888-663-6386. Email patrick at OneRadioNetwork.com. Here's your host, Patrick Timpone.
Well, good morning. Good morning. This is One Radio Network, Patrick Timpone, and it's a Wednesday, the 15th. 15th day of November. And if you'd like to be on the show, you can do that. 888-663-6386. Email patrick at OneRadioNetwork.com. Every Wednesday, we continue our study into this thing called money. You can Google it and probably would get all kinds of definitions for money. And our star of the show on Wednesday is Andrew Goss. Andrew's been studying the same for a long time, 35, 40 years. He got into the gold and silver coin business many, many, many years ago, about the same. And he says that it found him. He didn't find it. He learned about the monetary system and at some point in his life decided, wow, this gold and silver could be real money. And that's what he does for a living. His company is SDL. So a little disclaimer, he's also a currency historian, and he's written two books, Secret World of Money and Uncle Sam Cooks the Books, and he studies this stuff, and he's working on a third. Mr. Goss, good morning to you, sir.
Good morning, Patrick.
How are things up in Jersey?
Oh, fabulous. We have a new governor now.
Yeah, and he's a Dem.
Yeah, he is.
Of course, you guys are... You guys
are a blue state.
You're a blue state, right? Blue state, yeah. That's why your taxes are so nice.
And believe it or not, this gentleman ran on the platform of vote for me and I will raise your taxes.
Oh, did he really? So everybody voted for him.
Well, sure. That's what happens in a democracy. You know, the majority of the state is less than wealthy, perhaps, and so they vote to tax the rich.
So are there really billions of people, kind of dumb question of the day, on the left, that really believe that government really is the way to go?
Oh, yes.
I mean, they really believe that. It's kind of like religion, really?
Government's supposed to take care of everything. You're not supposed
And then it's
to
okay to take from the rich people?
The rich people. Just take from them. People. Yeah, yeah. Robin Hood, alive and well in New Jersey.
It is true, though. I've seen charts that the top 1% of the people pay... I think it's half the taxes. Don't they pay half the taxes?
Yes, they do.
No.
But they don't deserve a tax cut at all. You know, we need to tax them more and give everybody else a tax cut. That's the mentality of that ultra-left ideology.
Of course, on the other side of the coin, I had another article where the 1%...
Yeah, they got richer, didn't
they? They got richer, and they actually own about half of the... Well,
half of everything.
Half of everything, and they pay half the taxes. Well, that makes sense.
Makes sense.
See, I just put that together. Thank you very much. You know, it was a ha-ha moment.
And a new millionaire every 30 seconds in the United States.
Really?
Did you catch that?
No. So that means, though, everything, right? If you sell your couch and everything and you do the debits and credits, you come
net
up
worth,
with a million.
Net worth of $1 million.
Yeah, yeah. Of course, I can remember the day that used to be a lot.
Yes. Hate to sound so cavalier, but... $1 million ain't what it used to be.
Remember the show? You're probably not old enough. There used to be a show called...
Who Wants to Be a Millionaire?
No. It was a drama show, and it was a nice premise. There was this rich guy, kind of a George Soros, and he would pick people out, and he would give them $1 million. Do you remember that? And it went to the people's home, and the guy's name was John Beresford Tipton. And it was a millionaire, called the millionaire, I think, and he would give them a check for $1 million, and then the half-hour show was about what happened to him in their life.
I thought he gave him $1 million, Patrick.
He did.
He gave him a check for $1 million.
Well, I guess they got the check. But that was a show. It was in the 50s. I remember when I was a kid, we used to watch
about
it.
That? Yeah.
Something about millionaires, something like that. Of course, if you did that now, you'd have to do, to make it really meaningful, maybe a billionaire. Well, maybe not a billionaire, but a lot.
Yeah.
But a lot.
A million, come on. I mean, I know so many people that $1 million would just change their entire life.
Oh, I know. It doesn't change my life.
Yeah, sure. So $1 million is plenty. if you're,
it's still a lot of bananas.
It's
no matter,
a lot of bananas.
No matter,
no which, matter how you slice them.
Uh-huh. All right, so let's do this. This is unplanned, but this is fun. Mm-hmm. Somebody walks into your office today.
Yes.
I work for a secret person, and he really likes you. So here is a check for $1 million. No strings. It's yours. Thank you very much. He's paid the taxes, mm-hmm. the gift taxes. He paid whatever. What would Andrew Goss do with it?
Probably $1 million worth of gold and silver coins.
No, you kidding? Rascal, you.
I would.
Can I just throw you a softball underhand?
Well, I think you just, if we were playing T-ball, you just set it up on the tee for me.
Really? Because... You would just spend it all on a buy more gold and silver?
Oh, yes. Yeah. Well, for me, I mean, that's what I do. Yeah. So the more, you can't sell apples from an empty cart. So this is why the bulk of my wealth is invested in gold and silver coins, because I need to have them. I always lay my money out first, see, and then after I buy it, that's when I offer it.
But what if you weren't in the gold and silver coin business? What would you do with $1 million? Buy gold and silver coins?
If I didn't know anything about
gold?
No,
if you, no. Just see if you didn't sell
If
them.
I wasn't in the business?
That's right. But you knew what still, you know what you know about fiat currencies. You would still, I guess still, that's what you would do, right?
Yeah, that's what I did, you know, before 1981. Which is when I formally went into the gold and silver coin business.
Oh, sure, when gold was $850 or
whatever. Of course. And after the peak, after that 1980
I'm getting
peak.
In, dude. This is it was $35.
That's the time to jump in. And then gold went from $850 to $280, straight down.
Yeah, it did.
But still, you know, I hung in there because to me, this is a long-term type of a deal. And, you know, getting through the low period from 81 to 91, you know, that was just part of the plan. So for us, it didn't matter. What our goal was to place as many coins with investors as we could when prices were low. That way we could go back to them when prices rose again and to get the coins back. So this has worked well for 40 years and 40, let's see, 81, 91, 2001, 2011, yeah, 37 years, yeah. 36 years.
Wait, I was watching it, looking at a chart the other day, 1970 charting what a dollar would buy.
Yep.
And it's almost an inverse thing with gold.
Yes, it is.
Just an inverse. I mean, it goes from the top left all the way down to the top right,
mm-hmm.
and then you got the $35 an ounce in 1970. Wasn't that what it was? All the way up to
yeah, when the gold window was closed in 71, the official price of gold was $40.22.
August 71, Richard August 15th. M. Nixon, yep. I am not a crook, he said. We're going to take us off the gold standard.
Yeah.
Yeah, baby.
Man, and I'll tell you, you know, as I look over my lifetime, no president has done more to harm the American public than Richard Nixon.
Really?
The closing of that gold window severed your... your guarantee, if you will, that the dollar that you put away would maintain its purchasing power. So, in fact, a dollar that you saved in 1971 when gold was $40 an ounce, and you saved it low these entire 37 years, 36 years.
Mm-hmm.
Today, what would that dollar be worth with gold at, where is it today, 1280 or 1200?
Something like that,
yeah. So, I mean, just simple math will tell you that's 100, 200, 300, 400 times.
Actually, a bigger percentage gain than the dollar loss.
That's right.
Which is interesting. Yeah.
Well, sure. Yeah. Because it becomes the only parachute, so everybody's anxious to get one.
You've heard of Ray Dalio.
Diallo.
Is it Diallo?
Yes.
Diallo, he is the...
Bridgewater Capital.
Eighth largest... No, he is Bridgewater Capital. They are the biggest hedge fund in the world, right?
That's right.
Well, he wasn't really into gold all that much, but...
No.
But in the second quarter, I've got my notes here. Pretty interesting.
Second quarter... He got into it now.
He started buying... So this is what I wanted to ask you about, because I'm wondering why he would do that. Okay, here it is. Second quarter of 2017, Bridgewater Capital, Ray Dalio, he bought 575,000 shares of the ETF, Exchange Traded Fund, GLD.
Yeah, he's a paper guy.
Ooh, it cost him $68 million, no bad, he wrote the check. And then he bought 31 million shares of IAU, that's another gold ETF, $37 million. So there's $100 million there. And then he came out in August of this year to all of his people, right? And here's what he says to all of his clients and stuff. When it comes to assessing political matters, especially global geopolitics like North Korea, we are very humble. We know that we don't have a unique insight that we chose to bet on, so we have to say that if things go badly, we would seem that gold, more than any other safe asset haven like the dollar, yen, or treasuries, would benefit. So if you don't have 5 to 10% of your assets in gold as a hedge, we suggest you relook at this. Don't let the traditional biases rather than excellent analysis stand in your way of doing this. This is what he came out 2 months ago.
Right.
And then he doubled down.
Yes.
Then in the third quarter, he bought a bunch more, 575% increase in his GLD holdings just this last quarter. Wow. And also he times three his IAU holdings. He's got billions worth of gold now.
Yes.
But he's buying paper, so I'm really curious. Here's this one of the...
Well, he believes in paper.
Yeah, but he's one of the, supposedly one of the most savvy guys on the planet, Diallo.
Yeah.
And you've told us before that these ETFs, GLDs, there could be, I mean...
If there's a recall of gold...
Why would he do that, though? That's a lot of money.
Yeah. Huh? Because he, like me, believes that the dollar may be worth less, but it's not going to be worthless. You know, he's not a collapsitarian or a crashaholic. The whole thing's going to come down into a house of cards.
Right.
However, if gold goes from where it is now back to where it was in 2011 and then breaks that barrier, that puts it over $2,000 an ounce. So just from an investor's point of view, and to me, see, I think he waited till the last possible minute to move himself in. You know, I've been talking about this for quite some time.
Yeah, he could have got in 5 years ago a lot cheaper, right?
That's right.
Yeah, that's right. Well, you should have listened to the show.
That's all right. You know, he does what he does, and he probably is a heck of a lot smarter than I am. So he waited until the very last minute and was able to do just that. Uh-huh. And this is the benefit of buying gold bullion or gold-related items. On the day that you decide to buy, it's all there waiting for you to buy. The same can't be said with rare coins. You know, they're there when they're there, and then they're gone. And it doesn't matter when you decide to buy it. If the coins aren't available, you're done. So for me, I just I get on this dollar averaging kick, and that's what I do. So
tell folks the mechanism behind exchange-traded funds, which are ETFs for GLD, and they also have SLV. And there's a lot of them out there, and that's a way to, in equities, own gold. You say it's dicey because there's you don't own it. You don't have it in your sock drawer, right?
You have a beneficial
interest. Tell folks
how
this works. This GLD
well, simply, thing. Simply they charge. They start this fund, a hedge fund, if you will, that's traded on the exchange, hence the name, exchange-traded fund.
It's just like Apple or something. You can buy it.
That's right.
Right.
And there's a bid and an ask. Mm-hmm. And the fund is based on you put in $1,000, and the fund buys $1,000 worth of gold. And
well, that sounds sound to me.
It's basically sound. Basically sound. It's only in extreme conditions that there may be danger. So in a normal market, in a Ray Diallo-type market, it's very reliable, very count-onable. And, you know, many of our listeners have called in the past and asked, hey, Andy, you know, I can't buy gold and silver coins in my 401k.
Right.
What should I do? And I've said to all of them, and I've even said it on the air here, buy an exchange-traded fund. GLD is one. The Sprott funds are another. So there are several.
IAU, that one.
Yeah.
That's one. DIY.
Mining share index or something. So it is possible.
There's a way to buy into
that's right.
The idea
take
of hard
advantage
money.
Right. Without having to liquidate your IRA or your 401k and pay the tax penalty and the 10% penalty if you're less than 55.
You can just move it over there, and then you're in. But did I dream this, or did you tell us that this idea of taking the money and buying the gold, that kind of has been gone by the wayside, or do they still do that, or do we know?
Well,
do they actually buy physical?
They do, but there are periods when they don't.
Oh.
And there are periods
that
when
doesn't
they,
work.
That's right. So it doesn't happen automatically. Like you put in $1,000 and they rush out today.
Oh, Patrick
and buy,
just gave us $1,000.
Yeah, let's go buy $1,000.
It doesn't work like that.
No, it doesn't. So it reaches certain levels, and then they make their investment and buy gold. But in many instances, they'll buy a gold contract or a gold future.
Oh, they don't buy physical.
I shouldn't say they don't, because they do.
But they're not.
Sometimes
so the fine
they
print
don't.
Gives them the...
The right to
do whatever they want.
That's right. And again, in extreme cases, 1929 style or 2008 style, you may see some disruption in your ability to liquidate. And in the event of a national crisis where the president decides, okay, that's it, we need to recall all the gold and reliquify the market. And so that
was
done.
Like they did in 33.
Yeah, Executive Order 6102.
I knew that.
And so if the president decides, okay, that's it, it's illegal to own gold. Hmm. If you have it in your sock drawer, you may decide, okay, you know what? I'm going to bury it in the backyard until it's legal to own.
And I'm not telling anybody. Don't try this at home.
No, but you may make that decision as an individual. And so in an exchange-traded fund, you don't have a choice. It's just going to be done for you. You'll get a check, and that'll be that. I mean, your gold will be sold, and no one will argue. So I'm not a fan. I must say, if you have no other choice, great. GLD's
it's
a good
better,
place.
It's better than...
Better than nothing.
Better than buying utility stocks or bonds or something.
Or bonds.
Or debt.
For goodness,
kind of debt. Yeah, some kind of debt like that.
Yeah. I don't know if you noticed, maybe this is what's kind of driving Mr. Diallo, but the risk premium on junk bonds has exploded.
Oh, I tell you, tell folks what that means. That's pretty interesting.
Yeah.
Because there's a lot of things going on with these small cap companies that people aren't talking about. I looked at this article and it was pretty geeky, and I'll talk to you about it, but go ahead and tell you about the junk bonds.
Well, essentially, in this low interest rate environment, a lot of companies have been issuing these...
A lot of debt, right?
Yeah.
So they've been borrowing money instead of getting their company together.
Right.
Right. We'll just, we're not making enough money on our widgets, so let's just sell more.
Yeah.
Or something like that.
That's right.
All right. So they borrow money to sell more widgets that they're losing money on. Sounds like Tim Pony's marketing, Dripping Springs.
Well, at any rate.
Yeah.
A bunch of debt was sold at very low yields. And so now the investors that are holding this debt are saying, well, it looks as though interest rates are going to go up.
Yeah.
The Fed is saying that they're going to raise rates in December. And as we should know, every time interest rates go up, then the value, the market value of a bond goes down.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah.
So they've been selling for the last month. Extensively, and this has driven the yields down and the price down and the yields up. So the junk stuff now is trading, I think, at an average of around 6%, which is great, since considering there's $11 trillion of sovereign and corporate debt that has a yield below zero. So 6% yield,
it's a lot.
For an asset manager, that's a lot. So we'll see what happens, but it appears to me, there was a big default yesterday on Reliance Communications. I think that's an Indian telecom, and they defaulted on their bonds. But at the same time, China issued a bunch of dollar-denominated bonds that people snapped up at a rate of 10 times the amount that was available.
We love the dollar. They got those pictures of dead presidents on them. Society Gen... this big numbers geek up there, he did a whole thing looking at small caps company, these smaller companies.
Mm.
And he said, and if you take this is a little geeky, but it's kind of fun. EBITDA, which is
earnings before interest and taxes,
and you divide it by the interest expenses that you're paying out on your interest, and that ratio. And, the bigger that ratio, the worse it is, right?
That's right.
And man, you look at some charts of these people, and there's a lot of companies, these small caps company, that are just their debt burden is just they can't even deal with it, So there's going to be a lot of defaults with these companies that I guess the big guys are holding them up, right? The Amazons, the Apples, and
that's right,
holding up the markets, right?
But I'm more worried as I am about the corporate stuff.
Yeah,
the real thing that bothers me is. The municipal stuff.
Okay, the Austin just did $1 billion bond that the people want. A billion.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, $1 billion bond. So municipal stuff, then, what does that mean?
Chicago, Illinois, and New Jersey, Hartford, Connecticut, you know, cities and states.
Just keep borrowing money, right?
Well, it's getting bad. Chicago's bonds, for example, have been downgraded to junk. I mean, if you buy a bond issued by Chicago, you're buying a junk bond.
And what does junk mean?
Less than AAA rating.
Okay.
So, and many pension funds, investment funds, and managed funds set their limit. They say, if it's not AAA, we won't buy it.
Oh, the dudes that are making the decisions.
That's right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So next month, Chicago's going to start selling bonds again, $3 billion worth of debt. And it, what it's selling is the right to receive sales tax revenue in a separate public corporation. So they're isolating the revenue stream and saying, if you buy this bond, we're going to send the sales tax revenue exclusively to pay for this bond. So so they're taking that revenue stream out of the treasury, which means that its older bonds are not going to have as much money backing them. So if they start securitizing their sales tax revenue, if the states start doing it as a...
That's like taking a loan out your business and you're actually using your revenue
as the collateral.
As a collateral. But that's really dangerous. So
it is.
What do they call that in business? There's a word for that loan.
Factoring.
Factoring loan. Yeah. You have so much coming in, we'll loan you this much because you got to give it to us.
Now, everything that comes in is now devoted to paying this new debt.
Right.
And none of it can be devoted to paying your old debt. So in reality, what happened in Chicago is that... I mean, the people that had existing Chicago bonds essentially saw their value cut immediately. So, I mean, they realized that, now my bonds, my general obligation bonds, are limited and they're not worth what they were when I put them in.
So big picture, I got to do this first, and then we'll be right back.
Okay.
Hey, you guys, you dudes, we recently talked to Daniel Vitalis about testosterone.
So many men today are reaching an age where they begin something we call andropause, and this is the equivalent, male equivalent of menopause. So we know women go through menopause, but less understood in the mainstream is the idea that men go through andropause. And so they hit a certain age, but men start to really drop off in their hormone production. So what a lot of people are using is drug forms of hormones. And as always, when you extract a drug and you give it to somebody, you create more imbalance. The drug is found usually in nature, but it's found with a suite of other substances that support its metabolism and keep our bodies healthy. So one of the medicines on our landscape that can be incredibly useful for this is the pollen from pine trees, because it helps to increase those anabolic hormones in the male body and helps to keep a male whose hormones have naturally started to drop up.
Thanks, Daniel. When you click on SurThrival through our website, One Radio Network, you'll see a couple of choices. The 4 P's has some different herbs and a little more kicking your giddy up. And then the regular gold pine pollen is there for you on any SurThrival link on OneRadioNetwork.com. We're kind of head over feet on this aloe product that we've been taking. And I guess I'm on my 14th half gallon. And you just thaw it out. It comes in fresh, frozen. There's no additives, no preservatives. They don't cook it, man. It's just the bomb. And comes in these half gallon containers. And the minimum you can purchase is 2. They also throw in a nice little tube for your face, and it's really a nice product. Aloe has so, so many benefits. If you have any kind of bowel thing going on, whether it be acid reflux, heartburn, irritable bowel syndrome, just poor digestion, poor elimination, aloe is wonderful for that. It's very cooling, and it soothes everything. And you can just ask Dr. Google about the benefits of aloe, and you can go on for days. Pretty magical product. It's just it's a cactus kind of a thing, and you'd have to have a kabillion little plants to get the amount, a half gallon, filleting it out. They don't use the outer outer stem. That's an irritant. And this is Beautiful Aloe, Stockton Aloe, front page, One Radio Network, right under the slideshow. And you can try some of this aloe. Get yourself a couple half-gallon containers. You get a tube of a nice little product for your face. And you'll enjoy it. And I think you'll just keep buying more and more and more like I've been doing. I'm getting two at a time now after ponying up for a four-gallon thing. Pretty fun. And it's on OneRadioNetwork.com right under the slideshow. Please keep in mind, if you like to shop at Amazon like the rest of the world, boy, it's pretty amazing the model that they have. The Prime thing, $99, and you get it in 2 days. It's crazy, you know. We've talked about how they do it. Well, a lot of people like to shop Amazon, especially holidays and things. Please bookmark Amazon. Bookmark it. In other words, go through One Radio Network. You'll see the icon right there on the right side. Click on that and then bookmark that. And every time you go to Amazon, they'll still know it's you. You won't have to log in. It's cool. We'll just get a commission on all the Amazon sales, whether you buy a new car or a tube of toothpaste. Amazon.com. It's a nice little income stream for us. Not a great deal of money, but it all helps, and we appreciate you doing that.
Broadcasting live, weekday mornings, this is listener-supported One Radio Network. Good morning. This is OneRadioNetwork.com. The telephone number is 888-663-6386. Email patrick@OneRadioNetwork.com.
Okay, Andrew Goss, it's the Real World of Money. Come on and join us. Don't be shy. Love to talk to you. 888-663-6386. Email patrick@OneRadioNetwork.com. Computer right here in front of me, and we'll get your emails and get a question or a comment to Andrew Goss, currency historian. patrick@OneRadioNetwork.com. We're live every day, 9 to 11 o'clock. And on Wednesdays, it's the Real World of Money. Well, the thought came to me while we were talking about this, Andrew. Somebody sent me these pictures from the 50s and all these different quotes from people. And it started pretty interesting. In 1955, 62 years ago, here was a quote from this fellow. He had a picture of his family. He says, "I'll tell you one thing. If things keep going the way they are, it's going to be impossible to buy a week's groceries for $10. Isn't that incredible?
If you could feed your family lunch for $10, it would be incredible.
And then here's another quote from somebody. They have a picture. "Have you seen the new cars coming out next year? Won't be long before $1,000 will only buy a used one." You know, that's just, it's priceless, these kind of quotes. Sure. But then you think back to, I thought back when we were a kid, and I think our house payment.
$125.
Yeah, I think it was about $125. Mm-hmm. And that's all the debt my dad had. I mean, that was it. I mean, there wasn't credit cards back then.
No.
That was it. And I'm thinking now, what is the, if you will, spiritual or philosophical idea of buying stuff on credit and credit and credit? Now it's morphed into everything. The government is $20 billion in bonded debt.
A trillion.
20 trillion.
If it was just 20 billion, we could pay that out of the couch.
20 trillion in bonded debt. And that's just bonded debt, as you taught us. I mean, what has happened over the last 50 years? What's philosophically, something just went upside down.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean,
the idea that you have to actually work for something has gone out the window.
In other words, work for it, earn it, and then buy something?
Correct.
I see. Huh, how'd that happen? Yeah.
How did that happen?
Yeah, how did that happen?
Yeah, well, the first store that says, you know, hey, you can buy our furniture and you can pay us later.
Yeah,
you know,
30 days, 90 days, or whatever.
Yeah.
It used to be 30 days was a big deal.
90 days, same as cash.
Now it's 2 years, same as cash.
Yeah.
You hear it all the time.
Yeah. 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 So this, it just made its natural expansion. But I think, you know, the very first credit card right around...
1960?
Well, no, I think it was the Diners Club, right?
I don't know.
Yeah, the Diners Club I think in 1948.
Oh, really?
If okay. I could be wrong.
Yeah. But I mean, nobody had that. I mean, no real people, just rich dudes, right?
Well, yeah. Well-known people. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, naturally, the credit card became the mainstay of economic life. And at that time, Americans spent about 80% of what they earned. And now we spend about 125% of what we earn.
Wow.
And that number got about as high as 150, as I recall, during the pre-Great Recession levels. That's when we had those, I don't know if you remember, the 125 mortgage?
No.
Okay, so let's say you went to buy a $100,000 house.
Yeah.
And instead of giving you a $100,000 mortgage, the bank gave you a $125,000 mortgage so that you can go out and buy new furniture as well.
Oh, good for them. Oh, that's, I do remember it. When was that hot?
Well, you know, this was 2005, yeah, 6.
Which was leading up to the whole mortgage.
Of course. Yeah, of course.
So money for,
money for
sense.
Nothing.
Yeah, buy some furniture. It'd be good.
Now, Thomas Jefferson called it swindling posterity because, you know, you're laying your debts off onto the next generation. It's what we've effectively done as a nation. We've used all this wealth to be repaid in the future. And as I've discussed on prior shows, 77 cents of every tax dollar collected today is used just to service this debt.
That's amazing.
It is. It is. But, you know, in reality, we could easily get to 100% where all of the tax money that we collect is necessary just to service the debt. And then how do we pay for new things? Take a guess.
We borrow it.
Borrow more money. Yes. Yes, indeed. And is there a point where that number just keeps increasing? So imagine yourself in this circumstance. You turn 21 years old and somebody hands you a credit card. Mm-hmm. And they tell you, look, you can use this credit card all you want. Just pay interest. And if you find yourself unable to pay interest, you can borrow more money and pay interest. And so in the beginning, maybe you start, you just use 10% of it, 15% of it. And then after a while, you realize, well, this is easy. And I can afford the $2 in interest. I might not be able to afford the $200 item, but I can afford the $2 in interest.
Sure.
And so people start using it more and more. And then when you reach 100%, then the question at some point has to become, well, why am I even working at all? If I can borrow the money to buy everything I need and then borrow the money to pay the interest, I'll just stay home and watch this new big screen TV I bought. Mm-hmm. Because, I mean, there is no point in fiscal responsibility at all. And Dick Cheney started it from the federal level when he made that famous statement, deficits don't matter. Spending more than you take in doesn't matter. And once the government adopted that view, then goodness, there's Katie bar the door, as they say. There is no limit to how much money can be created and lent into circulation.
Democrats have proposed a bill that's going to come out next week. This is good. You're going to like this one. Mm-hmm. Okay. It's going to allow pension funds to borrow, right, from the United States Treasury.
Sure.
To remain solvent.
That's right.
Of course, the Treasury, there's one problem.
Doesn't have any money.
Doesn't have any money. So what they're going to do, of course, if this would pass, would be to create an IOU, borrow the money, and then the pension funds would borrow from that that fund. You know, this is not going to end well. You know what's going on.
Well, of course not, but it's a bailout.
It's a bailout.
It's exactly what I predicted.
And the taxpayers end up paying for it.
That's right. End up paying for it twice. Yeah.
Twice?
Well, sure. They paid for it in the first instance, and now they're paying for it again.
What do you mean?
So maybe Chicago's taxpayers paid for the first issuance of bonds, and now the nation's taxpayers will pay to bail Chicago out.
Oh, well, this is good. You know, this just keeps going like that. Hey, what's the name of this thing? You got to love the name. It is something like the...
Save America.
Something rehabilitation fund or something like that.
Yeah, you got to love it. Yeah. And it's all going to be done with dollars that are worth substantially less. The wimpy effect, you remember? I'll gladly pay you Tuesday for a hamburger today. And, you know, we will, of course, make it smaller and smaller hamburgers, in our case, smaller and smaller dollars, as a result of all this.
Oh, here it is. Pension Rehabilitation Administration.
great.
Doesn't it sound great? Doesn't it sound
well,
great?
Sure, because it's going to be just like the Resolution Trust Corporation. So they form this separate off-the-books entity that issues all of these bonds, and then the proceeds from those bonds are used to bail out the municipal bonds, and that'll keep the ball rolling for another year or
when
two.
When was that?
What's that?
The Resolution Trust Corp.
Oh, when did the savings and loans go bankrupt?
Oh, 86, 87, something like that. I was in Austin, what was it, late 80s, 85, 84, something like that.
Yeah, 84 is when the Ohio crisis
So this
broke,
is the same thing. They create a corporation, Resolution Trust Corporation.
Correct.
They put out treasury bonds. People
correct.
Buy them,
yep.
individuals, corporations, whatever, China. Yeah. And then they bail out the savings and loan.
That's right.
Isn't it clever? These guys are good.
And then today, we still send interest payments to the Resolution Trust Corp.
Today?
Oh, yeah. Today, yeah.
Oh, yeah, so that's part of the 70 cents on the dollar.
Yeah.
That's going out.
That's right.
Wow.
And
it
that's
just never ends, does it?
No. The expense for the interest payments is included in the budget, but the total debt is not. And so we never paid that money back. We're only paying interest.
Hmm. 30 years ago, this RTC was formed to bail out the savings and loans. And why did they need bailing out? Refresh my memory. What were they doing? They were so dumb.
Well, if you recall,
I think they were pretty solid savings and loans. I mean,
Charles Keating,
savings
was
and
the
loans.
Director of the. What was the name of that company? It was an Arizona entity that owned a bunch of savings and loans. And what he did as a microcosm, he'd go out in the desert, buy 100 acres of land, hire a guy.
This is not going to end well.
No. Hire a guy with a bulldozer and a paving machine to pave roads, and then separated it into lots. And then borrowed the money for the lots from the savings and loan that he had.
Oh, yeah. Clever.
So, create the value and then borrow that money.
Huh.
So everyone was doing it, and it got so big that, of course, the defaults were right behind it. You know, and like once we paved the roads and cut out the lots, then selling the lots became less important. Now what was important was going to apply at your own S&L for a loan on all these lots, which prior to that were just vacant desert land.
Do you remember at 1920, were you around? I wasn't here either. Do you remember there was this Italian-American dude, and he realized
Enzo,
that he could buy prepaid international postage coupons
stamps,
in Europe at dirt cheap, and then
he
could resell them in the United States.
That's right.
He got a few investors, maybe $1,800, remember? And he formed a new company.
Yes, he did.
The Securities Exchange Company.
Yes.
Pretty good. By the summer of 1920, the company's founder was receiving more than $1 million per day from investors.
People all over the world.
His name was Charles Ponzi.
Yeah, Enzo.
Enzo. Was it Enzo?
Yeah.
I thought it was, Enzo. Charles, something. It collapsed later, it was turned the Ponzi scheme, and that's where they came from.
Yes.
Yes.
And then Social Security Administration said,
let's do that.
That's a pretty good idea.
And isn't that the classic definition of a Ponzi scheme would be, let's see.
Taking the money from new investors to pay off old investors.
So there's a sufficient ratio of workers that are paying into this system versus the retirees receiving the benefits. That's when it goes bad, where right?
Yeah, and from my numbers, if you recall when we started this show, my numbers said that point would come in, 6 years ago, 2011.
Right. That's when that's when it kind of
6 years ago.
Turned,
we started now paying out more than we took in.
Well, that doesn't even take into effect, of course, that they took all the money, and this shouldn't even be doing it the way they're doing it, putting in the general welfare.
That's
just dumb. I mean,
yeah, the Social Security
right there.
Trust Fund with TEFRA in 1986. That's when President Reagan appointed the Greenspan Commission.
Oh, remember
that. Alan Greenspan came to America and said, "Hey guys, you're going to have a problem around 2011." And
did he predict the year?
Yeah.
I mean, math. Yeah.
It's just math.
It's just math.
And so the commission did their study and. They predicted that by 2011, the Social Security Trust Fund would be paying out more than it was taking in, and the necessity arose to beef up the trust fund. And so
they got a tax increase.
The biggest one in history.
Woo.
In history, under President George H.W. Bush.
Thanks, George.
Stands for Herbert Walker, by the way, in case you're wondering what the H.W.
Bush was. Bush 41.
You really need to look up Herbert Walker if you really want to understand George Bush. Anyway.
But don't get us started.
But don't get us on a side tangent. So he passed this biggest tax increase in history and beefed up the Social Security contribution, 7.5% from the employer, 7.5% from the employee.
And what was it before then? Do you remember?
Oh, it was half of that or less.
So
they doubled it.
The whole employee thing. Wow.
That's right.
That's a lot of money.
It is a lot of money. 15% of payroll.
Yeah.
You consider the nation's payroll. Every single week.
Yeah. Ooh.
15%
of it. So they doubled what they were bringing in.
Just in Social Security.
Right.
You know, the individual income tax is also another item that's rather large. So between the two, the revenue flowing into the Treasury exploded. It just exploded.
You think?
And for the next, 30 years, we built an enormous surplus. Mm-hmm. Such a surplus that when Bill Clinton borrowed it all... And reported to us that
there
was...
Are you really going to use the term borrowed?
Well, that's what he did. He borrowed it. Okay. Yeah. He didn't steal it. Mm. He didn't, take it and go buy land in Arkansas or something.
He didn't give it to any of his girlfriends.
He didn't pass it. Well, maybe a little bit. But the bulk of it was devoted to offsetting the deficit in the general income tax or in the general fund. So now, instead of reporting to the nation a continuing deficit in the general fund, he borrowed all the money from the Social Security Trust Fund and used it to pay the deficit in the general fund and then reported a surplus. And in fact, I remember when he brought out that chalkboard and put that big zero on it.
I remember that.
Yeah, here it is, folks. This is our deficit now, zero. And he led the nation to believe that he had somehow magically paid off the national debt.
People still say it to this day.
Oh, yes, they believe it.
Oh, remember when Bill Clinton...
Paid off the debt?
Yeah.
Never did, of course. The only time the national debt has ever been paid in the history of our country was in my hero president, Andrew Jackson, the Democrat, his term. January 1st of 1835, he paid off the national debt. Can you imagine? A nation that was debt-free. Man, no wonder we had a boom in growth from 1835 until the dawn of the Civil War. This nation was booming. There was money everywhere. It was easy to get things financed. Funding was there. Investors didn't have a choice to go buy a government bond that guaranteed them payment. They had to take risk in the marketplace, and they did. They couldn't buy a government bond, so they bought bonds in Singer sewing machine. Maybe they bought stock in Carrier refrigerator, and it just went on. So we had a growth period in this country that's been unequaled, and I don't think we could ever equal it again unless we paid off the national debt.
God love Andrew.
Yes,
you think
indeed.
With a guy like that, they would take a pot shot at him at some, or something like that.
Andrew Jackson used to walk around with these two tough security guards, always armed. Still, you're right. Assassination attempts galore.
Amazing.
Lone nut gunmen tried to kill him so many times. One particular instance, probably the most famous one.
We shouldn't be laughing.
Because it's not funny, right? So the most famous attempt was the guy with the two pistols and both misfired, and Andrew Jackson beat the hell out of him with a cane. But he was shot a number of times. In fact, died with much lead in his body, and it didn't stop him. It did not stop him. Vote for me, and I will kill this bank. And what he was referring to was the nation's central bank.
He was.
And I'm going to come down again on the Federal Reserve System today. I have to. It's my job. You know, the Federal Reserve System was put into place in 1913 with a perpetual charter.
Perpetual. Yeah. The other ones were always 20 years. Right?
Always 20 years. Yeah. 20-year charter. You see how it works. After 20 years, you decide you're done. We'd get a divorce, and it's sunsets. It's automatic.
This is forever,
this one is a perpetual charter.
Woo.
So now, in 20 years, from 1792 to 1811, the first bank of the United States used its power and its influence to corner all the critical industry in the United States. So anything new that came out, any new development, any new process, anything lucrative, they would take notes issued against the nation's tax deposits, and they would buy whatever it was. And so by 1811, Congress and the president said, yeah, we've seen your game. We've watched it for 20 years. You've grown incredibly wealthy. You've abused your positions. We're going to cancel your charter.
But way back then, you told us that Treasury did have a percentage into the central
20%.
Bank. 20%, which is
But that was gone by 1808.
By
1808, yeah, Wolcott.
So then, after 1808, the boys owned this bank.
That's right.
And they were buying everything.
Yeah.
But creating the money.
Yeah, and when the government was a partner, we had modest revenues.
Yeah.
But once they bought out the government shares, then revenues skyrocketed. And for the last 3 years of their existence, they were like a profit machine.
Amazing.
And they were taking out scads of profit from the backs of the American people without their knowledge, really. But the Congress, wiser, said, nah, this isn't going to work. We cancel your charter. We revoke it.
We're going to be our own central bank.
Yeah, we don't need you. Mm-hmm. We don't need you at all. And with that, the British invaded. Now, the British decided to give us a hard time again.
Because they were big stakeholders in this bank.
You think? The majority of the shares were owned by the same British bankers that controlled American commerce prior to 1792. So it's what Madison referred to as clinching defeat from the jaws of victory. You know, backwards. Clinching victory from the jaws of defeat.
Of course,
Very clever, right?
Yeah.
So we had won the Revolutionary War. We had started our own country and issued our own constitution and then gave away the most valuable franchise that a nation can have, and that's its sovereign ability to issue money and to keep the seigniorage, the difference between the face value or the metal value of the money and the cost to make it and put it into circulation.
Wow.
So,
and that's what your conjecture is that the War of 1812 was all about, that the British were just not
happy. Okay, let's put it this way. So the charter expired in 1812.
Yeah.
Congress declined to renew it in 1811, and the British immediately invaded.
Mm-hmm.
And they bombed Baltimore and burned Washington, chased Dolly Madison off with the Constitution secreted in her undergarments.
God love Dolly.
Yeah.
So what do they, I don't even remember because I didn't pay attention during school. Well, in school, what do they teach that the War of 1812 was about?
The British were harassing American shipping interests.
Oh, I see.
You know, kind of like you would do if somebody was not doing things your way. Let me show you what pressure I can exert on you. So the cause and effect, the way the historians describe it, is the British, for some strange reason, started boarding American ships and hauling off American sailors and saying, okay, you're in the British Navy now. Impressment, they call
Amazing.
It.
Amazing.
Impressment. And so they view that as the cause of the War of 1812. I view it as the effect of saying we're not going to renew your bank charter.
Mm.
So the cause was we're not going to renew your bank charter. The effect was, okay, then we're going to board your ships and take off your sailors. Then, of course, we go to war. Now those are fighting words, and we go to war. And the British said, fine, you want it that way? We'll see you in a minute. They sailed across the ocean, invaded Baltimore, invaded the United States, put a land army on the shores of the United States, walked through Baltimore and Maryland like it was a countryside walk, and went into Washington, D.C., burned the White House, burned the official government buildings, chased off the inhabitants, and then decided, maybe we'll just go home. And what changed? What changed that you guys will just go home now? Well, you rechartered the Second Bank of the United States.
Well, so they acquiesced.
Sure.
Yeah.
We gave them the Second Bank of the United States.
So they wouldn't burn the White House down.
Well, they already
or
burned
they
it.
Wouldn't
yeah.
keep going west.
Yeah, keep going. Take the whole thing. I mean, we would have lost. No question about it.
Wow.
So some deal was struck in the back of the room, smoky room. Here, look, you sign this, we'll sign that. And next thing you know, there's a peace accord.
Hmm.
But not before the British decide, you know what? Let's just take the port of New Orleans from these people.
Yeah.
And so in 1814...
took a little trip down in Mississippi to them, or whatever.
That was Jackson.
That was Jackson.
That was Jackson, who knew, okay, they've in Washington, they've concluded a peace agreement with the British, and the war's over. And what do you know? Those dastardly Brits decided to invade New Orleans. Now, British historians today say, oh, well, communication was slow, and they didn't get the word that this treaty was signed, the Treaty of Ghent, I believe it was. And so,
but you're not buying that.
And I'm not buying it for a minute. And they went down to New Orleans with the British military, what was gathered now after they had done their dirty deeds in Washington and Baltimore. And waiting for them there was Andrew Jackson with a bunch of militia. And, man, they haven't taken a beating like that since Lexington and Concord.
Good for Andrew.
Man, he put it to them, and they withdrew with their tail between their legs, and New Orleans stayed safely in the United States. Thank goodness. Can you imagine? Had the British taken the port of New Orleans, they would have kept it. I doubt it would be British territory today. It would be like Hong Kong.
Well, as a great Huey P. Long once said, the only thing new in this world is the history you don't know. That's pretty great. Let's go to the phones. Good morning. Who's this?
Yes, good morning. This is Alan from Vancouver Island.
Hi, Alan. Go ahead. You're on the air with Andrew Goss.
Sure, okay. Just one little tiny little correction there before I get to the questions. That was actually, well, the way I've heard it, I read it in historical books, that it was actually Canadians that went down and sailed up the river there and burnt down your whatever the place was the president lived. And then when they left, the house was the president's residence was quickly rebuilt, and then they painted it white. They just whitewashed it, and that's how it got its name. Anyways, that's the way I heard the history.
Canadians? I don't know what you
mean. Yeah, well, British troops stationed in Canada.
Oh, British troops stationed.
That's what it was. Yeah.
Because that's the first place we attacked, you know, when we decided that we were going to war with the British. We had Brits just over the Canadian border. So we went up to a very famous Canadian city. The name eludes me now. Doggone it.
Quebec City.
Was it Quebec City?
No. Quebec City or Montreal?
No, it was one that we burned. And they say that the burning of the White House was in retaliation for that. Forgive me.
Okay.
What's up with you?
That's great.
Yeah, that's pretty cool.
Okay. Okay, you okay with Kennedy questions?
Sure, he's a Kennedy dude.
Okay. I there's two questions. The first one is, I heard this somewhere. I don't know if it was one of the conspiracy things, or I don't know where I heard it, but I heard that Zapruder was a CIA operative.
That's correct.
Really?
Huh.
Abraham Zapruder, yes.
So they put him out there to take this thing? The film? Andrew?
Yes.
Because?
Well, that's a lot of conjecture there, but history.
Why would they do that? Why would you want a record of it?
Yeah, well, they were proud of themselves, Patrick. They were doing the nation a great
but
service.
But that's a fact, that Zapruder was a CIA dude.
Yes.
Wow.
He was on the CIA. He had the Matt company.
Yeah,
go ahead, Cole.
He had a top-of-the-line camera, you know.
Yeah, best of its kind.
Yeah, that's interesting. I hadn't heard that. I just heard that recently.
In fact, there was nowhere to get the film developed. I mean, you know, of course, that's the hard reality of what happened to the film after it was taken. There was no place that could develop it. So, anyway. He was located in the Daltex building, if you've heard a lot about the Daltex building. And he was there were two CIA proprietary fronts in Texas. One, of course, you'll know this one, the Dallas Council on World Affairs, you know, right?
Yeah.
CFR, early local version of the CFR. And then the Crusade for a Free Europe. So those two front organizations of the CIA had a bunch of members in it. Curiously, let me give you some of their names. You've heard of George de Morenschild. We've talked about George de Morenschild. Clint Murchison, who financed the entire operation there in Dallas and who hosted the party the night before at his house, where George H.W. Bush and Richard Nixon and J. Edgar Hoover and the others, got together. And then, of course, the Hunt brother, Haroldson Hunt, he was actually the patriarch of the family. All of these people just happened to also be members of the Dallas Council on World Affairs, along with Abraham Zapruder.
Oh, wow, interesting.
So he was in a member of two front organizations for the CIA.
Wow. Okay, my second question is, I heard this, I'm pretty sure, on Alex Jones. He said that somebody asked him or he put forward that Kennedy was actually a globalist. I'm wondering what your thoughts.
Globalist.
Yeah, Kennedy was a bit of a globalist, and this was at a time when it was okay to care about the rest of the world. So
yeah, he did the Peace Corps.
Yeah, the Peace Corps would probably be the main thing that I would point to. But I would argue that in given the choice today, were John Kennedy alive today and the president today, he would be a globalist with nationalist tendencies. So he cared a lot about the United States. Today's globalists, I could not say that John F. Kennedy was a globalist in the mold of today's globalists, who do not give a crap about the United States. That's a technical term. And President Kennedy would still be if he were alive today, he would be a nationalist and not a globalist.
Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah, perfect. Well, thank you very much. I love listening to you guys. As I mentioned in the past, you guys are the best financial education available on the planet today. And there you go.
Thank you.
Appreciate it.
I will point out that by the 25th of November, 3 days after the assassination, Zapruder's film had been sold to Life magazine, and the owner of Life magazine was Henry Luce, and Henry Luce was also a CIA construct.
Whoa.
And owner of, Life magazine.
Well, next Wednesday, actually, it'll be the 54th anniversary of the murder of JFK. Comes around every year.
Poor guy, Abraham Zapruder, died of cancer.
Is that right?
Yeah, in Dallas in 1970.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But just to wrap up on JFK, you're not expecting anything of any real smoking gun type
I got my two big pieces of smoking meat out of that 4,000, whatever, however many documents.
Oh, the latest one,
one. And the most important one was, of course, a letter. I read it, I think, last week on the air from Richard Nixon's staff to the House Subcommittee on Un-American Activities. They had called Jack Rubenstein of Chicago to testify before the committee.
Oh, good.
We know him as Jack Ruby, the assassin of Lee Harvey Oswald. But what's interesting about this is it was a letter from Richard Nixon's staff saying that, please excuse Jack Ruby from testimony because he works for President Nixon. So in 1947,
crazy,
Jack Ruby worked for Congressman Richard Nixon. The fact that he would pop up again, 15 years later as the assassin of Lee Harvey Oswald is just a coincidence here, folks.
I think it's got to be just a coincidence. It's curious, man, just curious.